This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And where it's going to take you if things don't change tells us that South Africa, indeed by 2030, may be in the failed state category from a security and social welfare standpoint. And that's a pre-pandemic forecast, which means that it could be worse by a long shot earlier.
That's Claude Bisak, CEO of international economic analysis firm Unomix, on data indicating South Africa's economy is heading in the wrong direction. Details coming up also. The interim government of Eastern Libya has resigned. And the World Health Organization says the deadly Ebola virus in the DRC's Equator province could spread across borders. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. A study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies says the Sahel region has seen the most dramatic escalation of violence on the continent since mid-2017. The group that formed the coalition of Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin and the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara increased their activity nearly sevenfold since that time to 999 events for the year ending June 30. Joseph Siegel, director of research and co-author of the study, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi which populations were most vulnerable to this rise of violent attacks by militant groups.
In terms of recruitment, marginalized Muslim communities have been a target for their activity. But I would also say these outlying communities are often in the crosshairs of these militant Islamist groups. These groups are often forcing communities to choose between support for the militant group or the government. And if communities withhold their support, they are liable to be attacked and their leaders killed. In fact, we've seen a significant increase in the level of attacks on civilians by these militant groups over the past year. Now, fully a third of all attacks by militant Islamist groups in Africa are against civilians. So it shows that these groups are not necessarily garnering a lot of popular support in these communities. Rather, they're asserting their influence through intimidation and coercion. And so it is these outlying communities that I think are most vulnerable to these groups' operations.
So what's needed to tackle the reasons behind the rise in violent activities in Africa by militant groups other than counterterrorism security measures?
This problem didn't arise overnight. It's taken many years to emerge to this state, and therefore it's going to take a multi-pronged and sustained effort to reduce it. I would start with the importance of strengthening government capability to reach out to marginalized communities so that there is some engagement, there's some level of services, there's some trust. This may require working through local community organizations that have higher levels of trust with these local communities. It's going to require higher levels of transparency. And all of this is meant to try to rebuild some solidarity with these communities, but also to dispute the negative messaging that these groups have been putting forward, that the government is responsible for their grievances. You know, it will require a sustained security presence. These communities are under attack and they need protection. They're not going to ally themselves with the government if they don't feel that they can be protected. And this is often the case in the border areas where there are no man's land. And so these governments are going to need to cooperate and improve their coordination in the border areas. And then last, I would emphasize the importance for a positive message and addressing the ideological dimension. These groups will never be fully defeated until the ideology of violence fused with religion is defeated. And this will require delegitimating that message. It requires sustained positive messaging and engagement with the communities, working with local imams to talk about how they can better represent the interests of their communities and do so with governments in a respectful way. I think it's when that message that it takes hold that we'll finally see the defeat of these groups.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research for the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. The interim government of eastern Libya has resigned amid street protests that erupted across the divided country over dire living conditions. Associated Press reports that Prime Minister Abdullah Al-Thani submitted the resignation of his government to Akila Saleh, Speaker of Libya's eastern-based House of Representatives. Both the parliament and Al-Thani's government, which is not internationally recognized, are allied with military commander Khalifa Haftar, whose forces control Libya's east and south. Hundreds of young Libyans flooded the streets of Benghazi and other eastern cities in the past couple of days in a spontaneous outburst of anger over the area's crippling electricity shortages. The protesters set piles of tires ablaze and blocked traffic on several major roads. The UN support mission in Libya said at least one civilian was reportedly killed and three others were wounded. Uganda police say an angry mob of local residents killed at least eight South Sudanese refugees in the West Nile region over a false rumor linked to a fight over grazing land. Police said they have arrested 28 people. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The incident occurred over the weekend at Rhino Camp, one of Uganda's biggest refugee settlements, and involved a mob from Uganda's Madi host community. Josephine Angushia is the Uganda police spokesperson for the West Nile region.
Some refugee boys organized themselves in a group and assaulted this boy for grazing animals in their area. He was rushed to the nearby health center in critical condition. However, the piece of information which spread out was that the refugees have killed one of their own boys from the host community. So the locals mobilized themselves in a group to go and revenge on the refugees, hence killing seven on the spot. Then the eighth one died at the health center yesterday.
According to Angushia, a team of police detectives was sent to the settlement where they arrested 28 locals.
Out of them, 16 are prime suspects in that matter. Then the 12 were picked just to assist with investigations also. We are transferred to West Nile Regional Police Headquarters, Arua, where they are detained and are going to be interrogated.
The bodies of the refugees have been taken to a hospital for a post-mortem. The police and Uganda People's Defense Forces, UPDF, have deployed heavily in the area to prevent further clashes and hunt for more suspects. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
A leading international firm of economic analysts is forecasting that Africa's second largest economy could be a failed state in certain respects by 2030. Unomix says a mix of bad policy decisions, corruption, the COVID-19 crisis, and unemployment are driving South Africa towards social, political, and economic meltdown. From Johannesburg, Darren Taylor has more.
Unomix CEO Claude Baisak explains that an economic forecast is a mathematical projection of trends and not a prediction. It sets out what may happen should current conditions remain.
So you take a bunch of very important data points that cover the whole spectrum of state performance, from security, national security issues, crime, to political governance, to economic performance, infrastructure, and social welfare and environment. And you compare that with other countries of the world so that you are not simply biased towards or against South Africa.
Based on this, he says his experts have objectively and neutrally determined where the country's headed at this point in time.
And where it's going to take you if things don't change tells us that South Africa, indeed by 2030, may be in the failed state category from a security and social welfare standpoint. And that's a pre-pandemic forecast, which means that it could be worse by a long shot earlier.
According to the forecast, the nation would be in a fragile state with regard to economic prosperity and political governance. Baisak says the African National Congress, or ANC, government has in some respects perpetuated the inequalities that existed during apartheid.
Fundamentally, things haven't really changed. We still have an economy which is characterized by massive disparities between, if you want, its first world, which is under pressure, and its third world, without wanting to be insensitive or politically incorrect. The ANC has failed to create an economy that actually employs people.
In much the same way as the racist apartheid state built an economy to benefit the white minority, says the analyst, so the ANC's policies are designed to advantage a tiny elite. Baisak says South Africa's in trouble because it's deindustrializing instead of the opposite. The country's economic mainstays of mining and agriculture are waning.
And we've seen a continuous bleeding of employment and formal employment. Momentarily in the 2000s, where we had a significant growth of the black middle class, but that has been arrested. And the key issue is, how do you possibly sustain an economy in the long term when only about 20% of the entire population is employed? You just can't do it.
Unomics says South Africa doesn't have the human capital needed to spark the so-called fourth industrial revolution that would allow it to prosper.
You have generations of people who don't know what the formal economy is, don't know how to work in a structured environment of either government or private sector, don't have the skills required, and don't have the resources to do anything more than sheer survival.
Baisak says the ANC government is bent on being a developmental state, investing enormously in infrastructure and capital-intensive industries, such as vehicle manufacturing, when it no longer has the money to do so. Yet, it's also trying to be a socialist welfare state. These two disparate ideologies cannot coexist, says Baisak. The government maintains the Unomics report is too pessimistic, and that it has policies in place that will eventually ignite economic revival. But economists say as long as the ANC continues to give multi-billion dollar bailouts to collapsed state-owned enterprises, this will never happen. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Leaders of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, will meet tomorrow in yet another summit on how to foster a quick return to civilian rule in Mali. At their last meeting on September 7th, ECOWAS called for a one-year transition with a civilian leading the way. They gave the military junta until tomorrow to name a transitional president and prime minister. Over the weekend, the junta proposed an 18-month transitional period to be led by a civilian or a soldier. However, the M5RFP protest movement rejected the proposal, saying it does not reflect the results of the negotiations it had with the military. The World Health Organization is raising the prospect that the deadly Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Equator province could spread across borders. Latest figures put the number of cases there at 113, including 48 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The disease is now spread into 12 of Equator Province's 17 health zones. Bamongo, the latest area affected by Ebola, is located between the Ubangi and Congo rivers. It is the second health zone to be affected that borders the Republic of the Congo. The World Health Organization warns this increases chances of the outbreak spreading into another country. WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib tells VOA the risk is heightened because Bandaka, the capital of Equator province, also is affected by the outbreak.
The population is also very highly mobile. Bandaka, for example, is a trading hub on the Congo River, and there is the fear and stigma surrounding the disease. As it is a trading hub, WHO is helping also to screen travelers.
Shaib says the risk of the disease spreading from Bandaka to DRC's capital, Kinshasa, along the busy river route is of concern.
This makes cross-border collaboration between the DRC and Congo more important than ever and will require coordination on disease surveillance and efforts to screen travelers.
To prevent the outbreak from spreading further, the WHO reports it has screened nearly 1 million travelers for Ebola at 46 strategic points of control. It says these efforts have identified 72 suspected cases of Ebola, helping to reduce the disease's spread. Equator Province is a sprawling, densely forested area. Moving around this vast, remote region takes a long time. The WHO says the difficulty of reaching infected areas and identifying and getting Ebola victims into treatment is hampering efforts to contain the outbreak. Another problem is funding. The WHO says the COVID-19 pandemic is draining resources and attention away from the Ebola epidemic. The agency says its appeal for $40 million has gone largely unheeded. The WHO says it has provided $2.3 million from its emergency fund to keep its life-saving operation in DRC from collapsing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The influenza virus, commonly called the flu, has been around a long time and normally kills over 12,000 people every year in South Africa alone, despite widespread vaccinations. But as winter ends in the southern hemisphere, almost no cases have been reported in the country where COVID-19 infection rates are among the world's highest. A recent study credits masks, social distancing, and other measures in place to protect against COVID. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Halima Dawood, head of infectious diseases at Grace Hospital, one of the largest public health facilities in South Africa's KwaZulu-Natal province. She began by noting that COVID-19 began to ramp up early this year during what is normally flu season.
So South Africa was very quick in adopting the cloth masks for the community. And during that time when we went into lockdown, schools closed and we closed our borders. That contributed also to us not having an influenza season. We haven't detected any cases since April in South Africa.
Why do you think school closures have been so important in keeping major influenza outbreaks at bay?
Because in 2010, when we had H1N1, we were having the World Cup in South Africa. So we also had the similar concerns. And we had the schools closed during the influenza season. And we didn't have such a large epidemic of H1N1. We were getting all this international travel into the country. H1N1 was all over the world. So we thought we were going to have a problem. And it actually was muted because the schools were closed.
So do you feel confident that the 2020 influenza season is behind you?
We're still worried. We've gone now into level 2 lockdown, and we may still see influenza because there's limited travel allowed. And I think if we get influenza, we'll get it from imported cases. Similarly, our RSV season, the third virus we're concerned about, we didn't get a typical season this year. We have a season, but it's a very muted season, and we think it's related to the social distancing.
As a doctor, would you please compare influenza with COVID-19? What's different? What's similar?
Both spread via droplet spread and contact, but the amount of spread seems to be more with COVID. As to why, there have been some postulates about ventilation and closed spaces, etc. But we don't usually see influenza outbreaks that we saw with COVID. But it may just be that because there's a population who hasn't been exposed to this virus before, we're seeing the spread more than we see with influenza. Because influenza, part of the population has been exposed before or has had a vaccination. The difference is the super spreaders that may have a high viral load that's spreading to more than one individual. But influenza, it's close contact.
What about differences in danger and mortality between COVID-19 and influenza?
Influenza, we get poor outcomes in the very young and the very old. Coronavirus did not affect the young populations. They were affected, but they didn't have severe disease manifestation. But the elderly is affected in both infections and has both outcomes. The difference is the way coronavirus spread very fast. There's influenza, we anticipate the season, we rumble through the season, which is throughout winter, and then gets warm and the season ends. But here the virus just came through and went away. So it very rapidly spread and the surge was over.
Influenza, of course, is a dangerous disease, but it's relatively well known. But COVID-19 has completely taken many experts by surprise.
Yes, I agree. And as a physician, the other thing that was remarkable was the multi-system manifestation. So although it was predominantly respiratory, people also presented with neurological manifestations, cardiac manifestations, etc.
Just on a simple clinical level, COVID must be fascinating for you.
Definitely, yeah. It's very stimulating, but I also want to say that it was quite a relief that we didn't have an influenza season because it would have been a storm of viruses. Just making a diagnostic distinction would have been a nightmare.
Well, thank goodness for small favors, I suppose.
Yes, definitely. And I think the other thing it shows that these simple measures, hand hygiene, covering your cough, maintaining social distancing, worked remarkably. You didn't need any fancy interventions.
That was Dr. Halima Dawood, head of infectious diseases at Grays Hospital, one of the largest public health facilities in South Africa's KwaZulu-Natal province, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Paul Rusesabagina has been portrayed as a hero in a Hollywood movie about Rwanda's 1994 genocide. But he appeared in a Rwandan court amid tight security today, charged with terrorism, financing terrorism, arson, kidnapping, and murder. Rwandan police say Rusesabagina, who called for armed resistance to the government in a YouTube video, was arrested on an international warrant. His family claims he, Rusesabagina, was kidnapped from Dubai. Rusesabagina was portrayed in the Oscar-nominated film Hotel Rwanda, using his job and connection with the Hutu elite to protect Tutsi fleeing the slaughter. He later acquired Belgian citizenship and became a resident of the United States. Rusesabagina has lived in exile since 1966 and is a strong critic of Rwandan President Paul Kagame's government. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.